I would like to announce three coming events. On next Thursday, June 4, we will hold our annual book award and music dinner. This event will be a ladies' night and will take place at the new Hilton Hotel. Cocktails will be served at 5:30 p.m. and dinner will be ready at 6:15 p.m. You may still purchase tickets for this event today from the young lady at the entrance to this room or at any time at the club office. On next Friday, June 5th, in this hotel, our speaker will be the former Secretary of Labor, James P. Mitchell. Mr. Mitchell is presently a vice president of Crown Zellerbach Corporation and chairman of the San Francisco Human Relations Commission. His topic will be the Negro problem in California, what's the score? On Tuesday, June 23, we will have a special Ladies' Day ticket luncheon at which our speaker will be the Honorable Anatole F. Dobrynin, who is the ambassador to the United States from the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Next Tuesday, the Republican voters of this state will decide whether to favor our honored speaker of today or his opponent from Arizona as the Republican nominee for the presidency of these United States. Earlier this year, we were addressed by Senator Barry Goldwater, who presented his views on how to solve the problems of our country. The Commonwealth Club of California, in accordance with its motto, Get the Facts, is privileged today to hear the other Republican candidate in next Tuesday's primaries, the Honorable Nelson A. Rockefeller, governor of the great state of New York. Governor Rockefeller has enjoyed a most remarkable career. Born a New Englander at Bar Harbor, Maine, he was graduated from Dartmouth College in 1930. After serving the next 10 years in the operations of his family's business at Rockefeller Center, he emerged as a public leader in 1940 as coordinator of Inter-American Affairs. In 1944-1945, he was Assistant Secretary of State, and in 1953-1954, he was Undersecretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. In 1954-55, he was Special Assistant to the President of the United States. Governor Rockefeller's career reached new heights in 1958, when he was elected New York's 49th Chief Executive, unseating a Democratic incumbent. He was re-elected in 1962. Both times he won by more than 500,000 votes. Our speaker is generally identified with the liberal wing of the Republican Party and is undoubtedly its most articulate spokesman today. Ladies and gentlemen, Governor Nelson A. Rockefeller.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed, President Clinton, Judge Bray, my good friend George Christopher, other distinguished ladies and gentlemen on the dais and in the audience here in the Commonwealth Club gathering. I would like to express appreciation to your president for allowing the ladies to be present. This is the first time I've had the opportunity of being before the Commonwealth Club when ladies were present. And I thank you very much. As far as the television's concerned, I'm glad to see that I'm not the only one who has some problems with this great industry. When I was out here 4 years ago looking around, trying to sort of feel the climate, at that point I was having separate but equal conferences with the press in one conference and then subsequently with television. And I'll never forget the time down in Los Angeles when the entire television industry walked out. And I finally succumbed as you did, Mr. President, and since then we've been having joint conferences. But it's a pleasure to have this opportunity and in these closing days to be here in San Francisco again and to speak to this distinguished group. I personally feel that the decisions that are going to be made here in California will have tremendously far-reaching implications. And you have asked me to speak on the significance of the California primary. And it's a pleasure indeed to have that opportunity and then to answer questions after these remarks. The real question, I think, that is going to be decided here in this primary goes to the very root and the heart of the future of our country. What kind of an America do we want to see 4 years from now? What kind of an America do the American people want to see 4 years from now? For some months now, I've been visiting your great state from one end to the other and talking with people about the problems that face America at home and abroad. I've given my views in depth on all of the major problems of the day. During my visit, I have met many thousands of Californians and have been deeply impressed by their interest and their keen awareness of the problems facing the nation, reflected in the countless questions that they've asked and I've tried to answer. Californians, I assure you, still have the pioneering spirit. Here, the challenge of tomorrow animates the spirit of today. This afternoon, I should like to tell you of my major concern about the present and what kind of an America I want to see in the years ahead as a citizen and as a candidate for the Republican presidential nomination. I'm concerned that, despite massive deficit spending and four-year-old promises to get this country moving again, the nation, under the Democratic administration, now in power, still has more than 5% of its workforce unemployed. But, ladies and gentlemen, I'm also concerned over the philosophy indicated by a prominent Republican seeking the presidential nomination, who has stated that the unemployed, and I quote, who have no skills and have no education for the same reason, low intelligence and low ambition. Frankly, I want to see an America with a framework of laws and a climate of administration which will encourage the creative free enterprise system to develop a full employment economy, an economy that will produce 20 million new jobs, 2,100,000 right here in California that we need in America in the next 5 years. Now, I'm also concerned that no serious effort has been made by the Democratic administration in Washington to redeem its promise of 1960 that federal civil rights legislation would be, and I quote, a first order of business, unquote, until after 2.5 years of massive demonstrations and turmoils in the streets. But I'm also concerned that the same prominent Republican has indicated his opposition to civil rights legislation on numerous occasions, that he has voted with Southern Bloc, with the Southern Bloc of Democrats, to refer both President Eisenhower's civil rights bill in 1957 and the pending civil rights bill, which came over from the House, to the Eastland Judiciary Committee, the traditional Senate graveyard of civil rights legislation. I want to see an America in which people of all races and religions live together under law and order, with mutual respect for each other, and with equal opportunity for all made a reality. I'm concerned that the federal government under the present Democratic administration is bypassing the states and centralizing power in an all-powerful Washington bureaucracy. Federal grants and aid are being made directly to localities without reference to the states. But I'm also concerned that the same prominent Republican uses slogans like states' rights and local home rule as an excuse for inaction on pressing needs, for evasion of federal responsibility, or for turning back the clock on social progress. I want to see an America where the people's problems are handled wherever practical by the government closest to the people, the state and local governments. And I want to see a definite reversal of the trend toward bypassing the states and centralizing authority in that all-powerful Washington bureaucracy. I want to see an America where states' rights are matched by the assumption of states' responsibilities, and where local governments are given the powers and the resources to meet their community needs. It is not enough to talk about government close to the people. What is needed is a reallocation of the nation's revenue sources to give state and local governments the financial strength they need to meet their problems. I believe this can be done by, first, the institution of a system of federal tax credits for certain state and local taxes paid by individuals and corporations. Second, the transfer of certain tax sources from the federal government to the states. And third, by a review and overhauling of the federal grant and aid system. I'm concerned that significant social problems like medical assistance for the aged and problems of the poor become great election year causes for the Democratic Party, only to be ignored largely during the 3 years between. I'm also concerned over the philosophy and the approach of this same prominent Republican, which he has evidenced by characterization of President Eisenhower's legislation concerning human needs as, and I quote, a dime store New Deal, end quote. I want to see an America that will meet the health care needs of our senior citizens, not as a charity, but as an earned benefit through a contributory system of medical insurance based on Social Security, not by socializing medicine, but by preserving the historic relationship between the patients and the personally selected physicians. I'm concerned over the present Democratic administration's continued reliance upon deficit spending, the piling up of the national debt, and the threat of inflation that this entails. But I'm also concerned about this same prominent Republican who has advocated elimination of the graduated feature of our federal income tax laws and has advocated that Social Security be made voluntary, thereby bankrupting the system and placing the burden on the general taxpayer. I want to see an America where financial integrity is restored to the federal government with a balanced budget by 1967. I want to see the practice of real economy and a start made toward reducing rather than constantly increasing the national debt, as we have been doing in New York State for the past 6 years under a Republican administration. I want to see an America with a dynamic economy that will provide growth without inflation, expanded international trade based on accelerated private investment in new plant and equipment. I'm deeply concerned that during the past 3.5 years, our alliances have been weakened and freedom has been in retreat around the world, in Cuba, in Latin America, in Africa, in Southeast Asia. I'm concerned that communist totalitarianism has had the initiative and that the United States has been constantly negotiating on items on an agenda prepared by the Soviet. But I'm also concerned that this same prominent Republican's response to the crises confronting this nation in the nuclear age are impetuous. I want to see an America whose foreign policy leadership is guided, as President Eisenhower so well put it in his statement last Monday, by, and I quote, calm, painstaking study of all the infinitely complex situations that confront us, whether in Southeast Asia, in Cuba, or wherever danger threatens or opportunity beckons, but carefully conceived action. In today's nuclear age diplomacy, there is no time for indecision, but neither is there room for impulsiveness. End quotation. I'm concerned that the United States, under the present Democratic administration, has not worked with its allies and has not utilized effectively the United Nations, the Organization of American States, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, to maintain and extend freedom in the world. But I'm also concerned that this same prominent Republican has publicly advocated on several occasions that the United States withdraw from the United Nations. I want to see America, an America that remains in the United Nations and keeps the United Nations in the United States. And I'd like to say that parenthetically, I had the privilege of being here in San Francisco during those 3 months when the United Nations was being hammered out. I was Assistant Secretary of State and working with the Latin American republics, whose support and whose wisdom and whose perception resulted in the modification of the Dumbarton Oaks proposal to include Articles 51 and 52, which made possible NATO and CETO and the Rio Pact Treaty. And therefore, ladies and gentlemen, I would not abandon the United Nations to the communist. For whatever its shortcomings, it is the only existing universal machinery for keeping of the peace. I want to see an America with leadership that can work with our allies in the full partnership of true alliance, a union of the free, strengthening the bonds among free nations, and so buttressing freedom and preserving the peace. I'm concerned over the expediency, vacillation, and lack of clear goals and principles that have characterized American foreign policy during the last 3.5 years. President Johnson's 120 foreign policies, one for each nation in the world. The Democratic majority leader, Senator Mike Mansfield's trial balloon for neutralizing Vietnam. And the Democratic chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Fulbright's chiding of the American people for looking at the world in moralistic rather than empirical terms. But I'm also concerned over this same prominent Republican who has suggested that we withdraw diplomatic recognition of the Soviet Union, a step that has usually been considered to be a measure just short of war, and so cut off communications between the two great nuclear powers, thereby increasing the danger of nuclear miscalculation that could lead to disaster. I want to see an America with a clear, firm foreign policy based upon principle to which our friends can rally and to which the uncommitted nations can be attracted and which the enemies of freedom will respect. I'm concerned over the failure of the present Democratic administration to understand the true nature of the communist challenge, and by the administration's tendency to confuse a change in the tone of communist policy with a change in communist goals. The record is clear that the Soviet and the Chinese communists do not disagree on whether to bury us, but only on how best to do the job. A product of this policy is the penchant of this administration for do-it-yourself dealing and trading with the Soviet Union and telling our allies later. But I'm also concerned over the same prominent Republican who has advocated that all foreign economic aid should be stopped. Such a step would not be in our best interest, for it would abandon the underdeveloped nations of the world to ultimate communist domination. I want to see an America that bases its policies on a realistic appraisal of communist objectives, strategy, and tactics. I want to see an America that will join with other free nations of the world in developing common positions and policies toward the communist world. Policies that will include a united approach to convince the Soviet Union to observe the commonly accepted rules of international trade. In summary, ladies and gentlemen, I'm concerned that opportunism and expediency, an overweening concern for the present at the expense of the future, are prime motivating factors of the party and the administration now in power. For nearly 4 years now, we have been witnessing the supremacy of the slogan over action and the triumph of rationalization over concrete results. But I'm also concerned lest irresponsible and narrow doctrinaire extremism become the hallmark of the Republican Party. For the logic of the recommendations made by those who espouse this backward course would strip our government of basic power and resources necessary to maintain our society as we know it, and would most surely imperil its future. I want to see an America that has confidence in itself, that regains the confidence of its friends and allies, and commands the respect of the enemies of freedom. I want to see an America that recaptures its enthusiasm, its faith, its vision in the limitless potentialities of the future. I want to see an America that reaffirms the values which made it great and make it the symbol of liberty and individual opportunity. I want to see an America that maintains the ramparts of freedom and secures the peace. To me, this is the true significance of this California primary. Thank you very much indeed.
Governor Rockefeller, the members of this audience have presented some written questions for you to answer, and if you would be kind enough to return to the rostrum, I will commence with the first question, which is as follows. Why didn't you fight for the Republican nomination in 1960 the way you are in 1964?
You've got something. Well, I went out and looked around, and there was no question in my mind, after visiting all parts of the country, that because of the 7 years of devoted work to the party, which Vice President Nixon had made in attending fundraising dinners and in assisting candidates throughout this country, that the party felt it owed him a rightful debt of gratitude, and that the commitment was firm, and that I'd better go on back to the state of New York as governor.
As president, would you keep the United States troops in Germany, yes or no?
Yes.
Well, that's very quickly answered. How many delegates do you expect to have going into the convention?
This importantly depends on Tuesday, ladies and gentlemen.
What is your reaction to the pressure tactics used by Senator Goldwater's supporters to force Loyola University to withdraw its invitation to you yesterday?
Well, they're reminiscent of what happened 3 days before when they forced the Elks to withdraw their invitation. And I think, frankly, ladies and gentlemen, they go along with the same kind of tactics which have resulted in over 200 calls to our offices in, that is, our headquarters in the whole Los Angeles area of California, saying that the offices were going to be bombed. Over 200 calls received by every headquarter office we have there. I don't think really myself this has much place or much part in America as we know, America, or in politics, as I think we want to see politics conducted. Thanks.
If you should become the party's nominee, how do you plan to wage your campaign in the South? What strategy do you intend to use to win Democratic votes?
Well, I would do exactly as I did in 1958 in New York, when everybody said it was a Democratic year and don't bother to run on a Republican ticket. I believe in certain fundamental principles. That's why I came into politics or government 25 years ago. It's why I've stayed in government. I believe in the future of freedom and respect for human dignity. I think it can only be preserved and maintained if individual free citizens each assume their share of responsibility for that preservation. It has been my privilege to be in government and to run for office. And when I run for office, I don't spare anything to reach the people and to discuss the issues. And this is what I did in New York 2 times. This is what I've been doing in this campaign. And ladies and gentlemen, if we as a party, the Republicans, select and determine on a platform that looks forward with confidence and with faith in the future and in the fundamental principles on which this country was founded, and if we select a candidate who believes in those principles and who is willing to fight for them, and we go to the people all the way, whether it's in the North or the South or the East or the West, and talk the same basic principles to all Americans, then I think our party is going to win in November. Thank you.
If elected, what changes, if any, would you make in regard to our space efforts and goals?
The space effort, as started by President Eisenhower, reviewed the possibility of sending a man to the moon. The estimate was $17 billion. The decision was that the scientific information available was not sufficient to ensure a successful undertaking, and that it would warp the scientific effort in the entire field, and therefore they continued without pushing out of context, you might say, such a space man on the moon program. And they were going to get there when the information naturally developed out of the scientific probing. 2 weeks after the Bay of Pigs, perhaps the greatest tragedy in the history of America, the present administration announced that they were going to put a man on the moon in a race with the Soviet. One can't help feel but that maybe there was some thought of distracting attention from the unfortunate events of 2 weeks before. Now it appears that that effort will cost us $40 billion. Our program today is running at a rate of more than $5 billion a year. It is warping the entire scientific effort in the field of space. I would terminate this one-sided race because the Soviet have said they weren't in the race anyhow, and then after we had declared we had a race, then the administration invited the Soviet to join us. This, I never understood the philosophy of that. If you're racing with someone, it's a little strange to ask them to join you, and if we were going to ask anyone to join us, why didn't we ask our friends and not those who would destroy us to join us? I would terminate this, what in my opinion is distorted effort, save $2.5 billion a year, and use that money for accelerated effort in advanced weapons technology, which in my opinion needs some further support, and in the peaceful use of atoms, which was started by President Eisenhower and which has seemed to have been pushed to the side under the present administration. And I think that we could achieve far more, both in the field of science, for America, and for mankind as a whole, on an approach such as that. Thank you.
How do your liberal views differ from those of President Johnson? Do these differences justify placing you in the White House?
Well, to begin with, I didn't know that President Johnson was a liberal. I'm a liberal in matters of human concern, ladies and gentlemen, but I'm a conservative when it comes to fiscal integrity and when it comes to the use of the free enterprise system to achieve job opportunities for all Americans. And I think that is the sound combination. This is the combination that was started for our party by Abraham Lincoln and has been our great tradition as a Republican Party. The comparisons with President Johnson, the analogy which some would like to draw, I think, are only drawn by those who are not fully aware with the details of either policy or administration and the differences, the fundamental differences that there exist between the Republican Party, my philosophy, and the Democratic Party and President Johnson's philosophy. I think to go into those now, I can if you want, but I think that answers the basic question.
So far, your campaign has been directed against Republican opponents. When will you speak for Republicanism and in opposition to the present administration?
Well, I can see the man who wrote that question, and those who are clapping have not followed my campaign, if you'll excuse me. I have taken, ladies and gentlemen, every basic, important, key issue with which we're faced today, whether it's South America, whether it's Laos, whether it's South Vietnam, whether it's unemployment, whether it's education, and I have presented in detail my views here in California, in Oregon, and other parts of the country on those subjects, on a positive basis, analyzing the weaknesses and the failures of the present Democratic administration. And also, ladies and gentlemen, I have analyzed, because I think it is a contribution to the voters here in the great state of California, I have analyzed the positions taken by my opponent in this race on issues and pointed out where we differ. And in my opinion, it's the difference between responsible Republicanism and extremism in the Republican Party. And I think you Californians have got to make that decision.
What would you do to improve our position in Southeast Asia if you became president? And then another question, what can be done about Laos?
Three answers. First, we ought to have one policy and not a different policy for each nation, both in Southeast Asia and throughout the world. As far as Laos is concerned, it's one of the tragedies, also another tragedy of this administration, when the Laotian government first asked this administration for help in fighting communist guerrillas, the administration said yes, and they sent out units of the Navy. Then shortly thereafter, they asked for a ceasefire. Under the ceasefire, the communists made tremendous gains. Then the next step was for this administration to join with the Soviet in requesting or demanding a coalition government and a neutralization of Laos. The history of coalition governments since communism came into the world has been that whether it was China or countries in East Europe, they always ended up communist. Communist dominated. Therefore, it's hard to understand how we could have participated with the Soviet in such a request. Now, 2.5, 3 years later, the administration seems very worried because they've discovered that 4/5 of the country has been taken over by the communists. And they're sending special emissaries through third parties to try and get support from the Red Chinese to help straighten the situation out. In South Vietnam, they followed a different policy. But, of course, by having followed the policy in Laos, they did. The 260 miles of the common border between South Vietnam and Laos, all of that part of Laos is now under communist control, and it meets the North Vietnamese border so that All of the communist activities, the guerrilla activities in South Vietnam, are being conducted from North Vietnam and this communist-dominated strip of 260 miles of Laos. In my opinion, we ought to have one policy for Southeast Asia, and that policy is to defend freedom and respect for human dignity where freedom is attacked on the frontiers of freedom. And that to be effective in South Vietnam, first, the American people ought to know what we're up against, because this is a democracy. It's a free country. And if the government wants to have the support of its people, and if the people are going to have the opportunity to participate in the decision-making process, they've got to have the facts. And they haven't had the facts about Southeast Asia or South Vietnam. We've been told so many things, it's hard to know what to believe. That things were going well, they were going badly. The government was no good. We'd help bring the government in power. That the government had to go. The government went. Our friends were assassinated. Then we were told things were going to go better. The war would be more effectively prosecuted and the hopes and aspirations of the people would be more effectively realized. And within 2 weeks, the government was overthrown, and apparently nobody knew it was going to be overthrown. Then there was another period of uncertainty. And then we were told things were going better, and we'd bring out 1,000 troops, and the rest of our troops would be brought out by the end of 1965. They didn't mention, just by perhaps happenstance, whether that would be after a victory or in order to avoid a defeat. That detail was left out. Then Mr. McNamara was sent out on another trip, and he came back and said things weren't good, and we'd have to send back 1,000 troops and perhaps more. Then he went out on a second trip, and the president has asked for $125 million more for economic and military aid. So I say the American people really haven't been very effectively cut into the realities which many of these newspaper and other reporting members of the media, the news media, are familiar with because they've been out there and seen firsthand. I think the following should be done now. First, that they should follow in hot pursuit the communist guerrillas back into Laos or into North Vietnam. We cannot have an effective termination of this war if these people can go back into these sanctuaries. Secondly, I think that the South Vietnamese government should say to Laos and to North Vietnam, unless you terminate immediately the use of your territory for mounting this attack on our country, we, the South Vietnamese, with planes and our pilots, South Vietnamese, will bomb your supply lines or the supply lines of the guerrillas, the mounting areas for the attacks, and the supply depots themselves. Until these two steps are taken, I do not feel that they can possibly successfully conclude this military operation, and the continued loss of American lives will be the result. Thank you.
Here are two similar questions. What is your attitude on the recognition of Red China and trading with them? Another one, how do you feel about recognition of Red China, UN admission of Red China, trade with Red China?
Well, I'm opposed to recognition of Red China and trade with Red China as long as they violate the basic tenets and concepts of the United Nations Charter, attacking their enemies to try and dominate them, to take over and control the whole rice bowl area of Southeast Asia, as well as other parts, other neighboring countries. I'm opposed to their admission to the United Nations, but as I said earlier, I'm unalterably opposed to our withdrawing, if they are admitted, over our opposition, which is a possibility, because I feel that we would be abandoning the other free countries to the domination of Red China and the Soviet Union in the one vehicle which is the universal hope for the preservation of the peace. Thank you.
Just why do you consider yourself better qualified than Senator Goldwater to be boss of the H-bomb button, as implied by the campaign propaganda coming from your office to me yesterday?
Well, I suppose we all see ourselves in our own perspective. I have spent 25 years working in foreign policy with foreign nations under three presidents, in the State Department, in the White House. I worked for 7 years as chairman of President Eisenhower's Committee on Government Organization, studying the structure of the federal government, trying to bring about reorganizations to keep in manageable proportions this tremendous federal bureaucracy, trying to get greater efficiency in economy, trying to make the president's job more manageable. While I was in that job, I also, for Charlie Wilson, when he first came in as Secretary of Defense, chaired a committee for him to study the structure and organization of the Defense Department. We made recommendations. Those were adopted by the President and the Congress. I did the same kind of study, the structure of our foreign economic, informational, and diplomatic relations. And the changes that we recommended there were carried out. I've worked in the basic social field and as Undersecretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, which was one of the reorganization plans that the President recommended to the Congress, which we had worked on for him, elevating those problems of human concern to the highest level of government, the cabinet. I worked with Mrs. Hobby in the study of all of the legislation affecting the five component parts of that department and then updating them in terms of the problems that our country faces today, including Social Security. That department has the principal relationships with state and local government, so that I had the opportunity of seeing those problems from the federal point of view. Then, as governor of the state of New York, now no longer the largest state in the union, I had the opportunity of seeing these same problems from the other side, the state side, of working with the federal government from the state side, of seeing this shared sovereignty structure which our forefathers set up between the federal and state government, and of being able to help assume responsibility at the state level in order to preserve for our system the rights of states, and also to reorganize through an amendment to the Constitution, the Charter of the State of New York, so as to give a Bill of Rights for local home rule for local governments, to permit them under the changing structure of our government today, with these tremendous metropolitan areas that sprawl out over local units of government, giving these local communities the right and opportunity to contract with each other for studies, to contract with each other for services, to save cost, but to preserve government close to the people. I've had, I think, a very fortunate opportunity to study government, to participate in the responsibilities of government on the international level, the federal level, the state level, and for 21 years as chairman of the Westchester County Board of Health, vice chairman. I've also been in business, at home and abroad, and in philanthropy. Ladies and gentlemen, these are the forces that make up the warp and woof of democracy. I think that a president needs to understand all aspects of these problems if he's going to intelligently and effectively be able to give the leadership which America has got to restore to the free world and to give the understanding and determined opposition to those who would destroy us, while at the same time building strength and respect for human dignity and individual well-being and equality of opportunity to the people of this great nation at home. It is for these reasons, ladies and gentlemen, that I have been presumptuous enough to seek the nomination for the presidency and the Republican Party ticket. Thank you.
Governor Rockefeller, we have many more questions which we don't have time to present. On behalf of the Commonwealth Club of California, we want to thank you for your excellent appearance here today and your frank answers to these questions. The meeting is adjourned.